Colleagues, welcome back to The Office and welcome to our podcast and presentation for today for the thrilling installment of Case Studies in Fraud and Technology Controls, Part 3. In this class, we are looking at case studies in fraud, frauds that have occurred around the world for different reasons, with an emphasis here in North America and the United States, to try to understand what the heck happened and why things went the way they did. We started the first part of our presentation here way back about a week or so ago, kind of examining the most recent report to the nations on fraud from the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, understanding essentially where and how fraud occurred, the different kind of key demographics and makeup of where fraud was occurring in the world, to hopefully glean some insight to, you know, some of the macro statistics that could be helpful to understand what to be concerned with in our organization. In this section, we started this in our last section as well, we started to look at some case studies, and we're going to pick up right where we left off, looking at some interesting news articles and examples that have happened over the last couple of years of where people had committed fraud and, you know, some of the news stories that had come along with it. So we're going to start our discussion with taking a look at the fraud for Cindy Mills and Matthew International, which is a funeral supply company based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You know, with Miss Mills here, you know, she was a treasury specialist. She had control and access to a wide range of capital for the actual company, and over a period of many years, stole a lot of money. And we'll try to understand essentially what occurred there. We'll also take a look at Rita Crunwell from Dixon, Illinois, who was charged with managing the financial assets and working in the you know, city budget office and financial office for the city of Dixon, and what she did essentially to defraud the people of the great state of Dixon and the great state of Illinois and the people of Dixon. From there, we're going to go ahead and start to take a look at some controls. We'll talk about, you know, for example, some controls in general and some different ways of evaluating controls. IT controls, for the most part, are broken down into kind of two major categories, general controls and application controls. In today's class, we're going to get as far as to discuss what general controls are and the areas that general controls focus on. And in the next edition of our class, we're going to go ahead and take a look at those application controls, which are applying controls at a specific application level. So like within the accounting system, controlling, for example, how and when and where accounts receivable entries are created or accounts payable or checks are issued, all that and more. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started with this. But before we do, I do want to remind you that if you are a financial professional, you can earn credits for watching or listening the CP Today podcast. After watching or listening, head on over to cpetoday.com and you'll take a short 5-question quiz and you'll earn a credit for today's class. We try to make our education fast, approachable, affordable for all methods of learning. And if you're like me, where you like listening to podcasts and you happen to be a CPA or some other type of professional that requires education, guess what? After you get out of the car at the office or after your commute from home, head on over to cpetoday.com. You take that short quiz and you've got yourself one shiny certificate to keep your education up and running. And besides, you know, our podcast, we have content on a wide range of topics, you know, from accounting, audit, personal development, applications, and more. So whatever your education needs are, CPA Today has you covered, and you can check that out at your leisure. So we're going to go ahead and start our presentation today, and at the end of our presentation, we're going to come back. We'll have 3 quick review questions, and then we're going to go ahead and wrap up for the day. Thank you, and enjoy. You know, I have one parting thought I wanted to give you as a result of kind of our last example here, which was the Rodolfo Olivius case, and then we'll move on to our next one here. This was the guy in Florida who was stealing from his employer using an unauthorized American Express account. You know, the one thing I would recommend, and I do this, and I hope many of you do as well, most of these banks, and American Express included, can send you email notifications when charges occur. You know, a simple way that they could have helped prevent this is they could have had certain transactions meet certain characteristics that could have emailed the controller, the owner, something like that, that level or dollar value of a particular transaction had occurred. I personally use this for any transactions over, I think it's $500. I got an email from American Express. And most, I mean, they've always been authorized. I mean, it's usually me buying something on Amazon or booking a plane ticket or something like that. But, you know, those notifications occur in real time. And I can't tell you enough how often that could be very useful for helping to reduce risk and exposure with respect to fraud. It's just through notification. So something to consider. Alrighty, so we do have some polling questions. We're a little bit behind on these polling questions here, so I'm gonna ask them a little bit more frequently, about every 10 minutes or so. So please keep an eye out for them. I believe this is our sixth or seventh, and we need a total of like 13 or 14. So just be on the lookout for that they are coming. So this class will conclude today at 4:30 Central, which would be 5:30 East Coast. And that would be 2:30 in my time. Okay. Alrighty. So let's go ahead and discuss our next example of fraud, which is going to be Cindy Mills. And then we're probably going to move on to discuss some specific types of fraud that we should be aware of today, including SIM card theft and SIM card fraud, as well as our discussion on detecting fraud with internal controls and technology controls. So the next example of fraud that I think is worth taking a look at would be Miss Cynthia Mills and her employer, Matthew International. Matthews International is a firm that is focused on memorial and funeral products. They're a publicly held company that operates in most of the country, offering large-scale funeral services. Decently sized, about $365 million. They're about a $1 billion company overall. They have about 11,000 employees, and they're based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the great city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, home of the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Pittsburgh Steelers and my parents. So Ms. Mills worked for Matthews for 34 years, and in 2016, she was charged with stealing a whopping $13 million from her employer, okay? And she did this through a fraud scheme that lasted from 1999 to 2015. Again, you can't tell me preventative controls or detective controls or really any controls are working if you're able to steal that quantity of money over that period of time. Mills' attorney pointed to a gambling addiction as being the fraud driver, but I feel at $13 million, I mean, it's got to be a heck of a lot more than just gambling. Mills' position was at Matthews was that of a treasury specialist, which put her in a position of receiving and then ultimately stealing inbound payments from her customers. Okay, she would then subsequently alter bank statements and vendor invoices to cover the fraud. In 2013, Mills created a company named Designs by Cindy and began initiating wire transfers from Matthews to her shell company. Mills was charged with mail fraud, wire fraud, tax evasion, and engaging in monetary transactions in a criminally derived property. Some of the things that Ms. Mills purchased: she had three homes, an $800,000 yacht, which even reading that now always makes me laugh. Like, that's bold. That's bold, you know? Respect the game, I guess, you know? Plus two other boats, because, you know, an $800,000 yacht isn't enough. At least eight cars, a snowmobile, three motorcycles, furs, designer handbags, and an army of jewelry. Okay? If you're interested, there is a great video that you can watch as part of the course materials, and you can get the full scope of the background of her story. Remarkably, in 2014, another Matthews employee also pled guilty to embezzling another $415,000. In this fraud, which was conducted by Peter Kalman, submitted and approved bogus invoices from a West Virginia-based company he controlled. As a dispatcher of delivery, Kalman negotiated rates and approved invoices with no oversight. So he was not in collusion with Ms. Mills here, but rather just this company had that poor of internal controls to allow that to occur. He started his crime in 2010. He issued 126 fake invoices to Matthews that were then approved by him and then paid out by him. He deposited 81 checks into his corporate bank account. And Matthews also caused an additional 39 checks to be issued after postal inspectors talked to him about the crime, including 14 that were issued after he was indicted. After his trial, he was sentenced to 33 months in prison in order to pay $415,000 in restitution. So what can we say here about these companies? What can we say here as a kind of a culture that was created at Matthews International? Well, obviously, to allow for this to occur not once but twice, but then also to continue to pay this person even after they were indicted is really kind of incredible. You know, as one person writes in here, no segregation of duties. And yes, I would agree with that. But don't we expect more from our publicly owned organizations? I mean, these companies are responsible to who? Shareholders. I mean, what kind of audit oversight board was this company running to allow this type of fraud to not only occur, but to occur regularly and for years and years on end? I just don't understand how you hide an $800,000 yacht. I mean, where do you put that thing? I mean, it's got to live in a harbor somewhere. I mean, I just don't understand how that could occur for that period of time. So as another person writes in here, absolutely no one was watching the hen house. And I would agree, you know, when the cat is away, the mice will play. Let's look at one more example of fraud in the news recently. And this is the story of Rita Crunwell and the city of Dixon, Illinois. Okay. In one of the more remarkable instances of occupational fraud, Miss Rita Crunwell stole $53 million, $53 million from residents and taxpayers of Dixon, Illinois, a town of 16,000 people. And as a quick side note, the childhood home of Ronald Reagan. Okay. So beginning in 1990, Crunwell started siphoning money out of the city bank accounts into an account that appeared to be legitimate, but it was one that this person controlled personally. Crunwell used the money to fund a lavish lifestyle that would otherwise not be supported on her city salary of $80,000 per year. And she had a quarter horse farming business. And I don't know anything about horses other than the fact that they are not cheap. There's a pretty interesting news piece if you care to take a look and watch a little bit about the background of this particular story, including with our materials here. Now, Ms. Crunwell was arrested in 2012. That means much of her fraud was committed through the recessionary period. When people were hurting already, this person was stealing tens of millions of dollars. She's serving a sentence of 235 months, and of which she has to complete at least 85% before she could be released. And she has been ordered to pay $53 million in restitution. I think you would have an easier time getting blood from a stone. The city recovered approximately $40 million from two accounting firms and the bank that was involved. So I guess in a way, maybe we're lucky that she didn't spend it all, but you know, at least there was something left over. You know, if we look at a lot of these large scale crimes, you know, I'm reminded of the Ponzi schemes, for example, of Bernie Madoff and others. There's nothing left over, you know, and the victims are left holding the bag and completely out on their own. Now, the question that comes to my mind, as I'm sure with many of you as well, is how do you steal that quantity of cash ever? I mean, even over a very long period of time, I don't understand how you could steal that quantity of money. But I guess with practice makes perfect. And as we've seen with some of the other frauds that we've discussed here today, well, they started a separate business. Okay, Crunwell committed her fraud by opening a bank account entitled RSCDA Reserve Fund, which was supposed to mean Reserve Sewer Capital Development Account. Of course, this was not an account controlled by the city. It was rather an account that it was controlled directly by her, despite its official sounding name. She would then transfer money from the city into this account. Okay. And once the money was in the account, she would then use it to pay her personal and private business expenses, including her horse farming operation, credit cards, real estate, vehicles, and more. During the budget meetings, Crunwell will explain the shortage of city funds by blaming the recession. Yeah, right. Saying that the state of Illinois was late on its payments to the city. And to conceal the fraud, Crunwell picked the city's mail up from the post office to keep other employees out and from knowing about that particular account. The fraud was discovered. Well, guess what? Crunwell was out on vacation, and another city employee requested copies of bank statements so that they could prepare financial statements and reports. And at that time, you know, the employee opened up the mail and said, oh, what is this RSCDA account? Well, sure enough, it was probably one of the largest frauds in the state of Illinois. Over time, Crunwell created 159 fictitious invoices to show the city auditors that she had funds that she was depositing into RSCDA that were being used for legitimate purposes. As an example here, on September 8th, 2009, Crunwell wrote a check for $355,000 from a legitimate account to the RSCDA account. And later on the same day, she wrote a check for $225,000 drawn on the RSCDA account and deposited into her quarter horse business to cover the cost of purchasing a horse. You know, absent of the $350,000 deposit, her $225,000 check would have not even cleared the bank. Unfortunately, with a lot of these circumstances, they just seem just so larger than life to seem like reality. So, folks, leave me a comment. Let me know what you think, what we can learn from this Crunwell fraud. Some of the things that immediately come from my thoughts would be, again, segregation of duties, switching things up, moving people around, not letting people never take vacation, but rather, you know, forcing them to take vacation throughout the year so that you can double check things. You know, certainly just oversight and audit, asking questions. You know, it's hard to think about what kind of banking regulations could be there, you know, enforcing people not to have official sounding names. I don't know how you'd really enforce that, but I feel like there's some culpability in there as well. Like somebody at the bank should have been in on this. You know, somebody should have been looking at that account and seeing how much money was moving through and maybe check the incorporation paperwork, the EIN, stuff like that. So some comments that come in here, segregation, rotating of audit staff, internal audit function and review. Absolutely. But you know, the thing I'll tell you folks is in a lot of circumstances, those already exist inside of many of these government agencies and larger institutions that we're looking at. The question is, why aren't they functioning well? In our next section, let's go ahead and take a look at some specific types of fraud. And the first one I want to take a look at is going to be SIM cards. Okay, for those of you who are maybe not initiated, maybe not familiar with this, or maybe have never had to deal with this on their personal phone, you should know that your phone, if you look on the side of it, there will be a little doorway, you know, and in that little doorway is this thing called a SIM card. Okay. A SIM card is like your key to get on the carrier network, you know, so Verizon or AT&T, T-Mobile, any of these, there's a SIM card, and that SIM card authenticates the phone to the network and allows that phone to be able to communicate on the network. Now, there's some additional stuff around this, especially for like iPhones and Android phones, you know, that are tying the phone, for example, to Apple or to Google. We're not talking about that. We're talking about to the actual phone carrier themselves, Verizon, AT&T, or T-Mobile. Now, think about that SIM card for a minute. Essentially, it links your phone to the carrier. And if somebody were to be able to compromise that account, well, they might be able to steal your phone number. Okay? Now, why is that important? Well, think about multi-factor authentication. Multi-factor authentication is one of three things. Okay? It is something you know. It's something you have and something you are. So I could test something you know pretty easily. For example, passwords are a great example of testing something you know. I could test something you are, which is biometric, like an eye scan or a fingerprint scan, something like that. But something you have can be kind of subjective because, you know, this could be stolen at some point. And if somebody were to be able to compromise the service, they don't actually need to steal the phone as they could just steal the phone number associated with it. And then anything that is tied to that phone, well, they would get rather than me. So if someone wanted to commit fraud, they could steal your phone and they would be able to get any two-factor authentication codes that might be sent to you. So anything that might be tied to that phone number would then become at risk for being compromised. So SIM card fraud is essentially identity theft, where somebody steals your phone number that we know to be you and then represents themselves as somebody else. And so if they have access to this, well, from this point forward, what they could then do is then they could, you know, take advantage of any cloud service that is using that phone number for authentication purposes. So they could, for example, use this phone for accessing your bank, resetting passwords at cloud providers such as Google and others. What they could ultimately do with this is that they could exploit the weak authentication that's present in a lot of service providers or to be able to get access to your account. Now, there's a couple different ways that this could happen. The most common way is that they trick the phone company into turning it over. Additionally, they could potentially collude with somebody working at a retail phone store to get them to do it. You know, so, you know, there's tons of phone stores. I've got the Verizon in town. We've got Spectrum. We've got AT&T and a few others here. You know, those guys and gals probably make, I don't know, 12, 13 bucks an hour. Maybe you slip in an extra $100 and you say, hey, can you reset this person's account and let them in? You know, let me in. And what they would do is they would invalidate your cell phone number and your phone, tying that number to that cell phone. And then they would move that service to a different person and ultimately to a different device. Now, either way, the crook gets access to your personal data, and this could affect both corporate and personal data, as anything tied with two-factor authentication would be tied to that. Let's take a look at the anatomy of one of these attacks and what that might look like. Okay, fraudsters obtain data on a bank customer through a phishing or social engineering scheme to gain access to the online banking portal, okay? Now, what they will do under the pretext of losing a mobile handset or having a damaged SIM card, the fraudster would approach the mobile operator by creating a fake identity of a genuine customer of the bank. Okay, well, what they would then do is deactivate the old SIM card that was in the customer's possession and then issue a new SIM card to the fraudster. Now, what's going to end up happening over a period of about 5 to 10 minutes is that that old phone will stop working and the new phone will start working. And the text messages and phone calls from the old phone will no longer be sent there, but rather sent to the new phone. And so with the new SIM card and the same mobile number, the fraudster will then receive bank authentication codes, one-time passwords, two-factor authentication codes, whatever. And they can essentially, you know, do whatever they want at that point, because a lot of stuff is predicated on the fact that that phone is secure. Now, when we ever sign up for an account and they ask you for your phone number, the assumption is that the person signing up for the account is providing their number. So if I, you know, for example, lose my password and they text the phone number associated with the account, well, what are the odds you lost your password and your phone? The odds are pretty low. So that's why this is a really kind of serious thing, is because it circumvents a lot of the technology controls that are placed with other providers. Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. This isn't extremely common. However, it is something that we should be aware of. There's a pretty cool video here included with the slides if you want to take a chance to kind of review and kind of hear how this has happened to other people as well. So some examples of this. Carlo Tepang sued T-Mobile in 2017, claiming that the company improperly allowed wrongdoers to access his account. What they did was they accessed his account, they transferred the phone number to AT&T, and then they used that phone number, once it was verified with another provider, to steal approximately $20,000 in cryptocurrency from him. Okay, this person was utilizing, again, like a bank. In this case, it was cryptocurrency, and he was using two-factor authentication. The fraudsters found out his number. They went to the carrier, in this case, T-Mobile, pretended to be Carlos. They got T-Mobile to unlock the account, and then they transferred the phone number from T-Mobile to a different service provider, in this case, AT&T, where they then activated the phone and got access to that number. Well, I want to point out, at that point, once the number was transferred to AT&T, there's really not much Carlos can do at that point. You know, you could transfer a phone number almost instantly now. So allegedly, T-Mobile indicated that before the crime, they could add a PIN code to his account, but this did not happen. Okay. And apparently the attackers were able to make repeated calls to T-Mobile representatives in an attempt to gain access to the customer account until they were successful in finding a representative that was cooperative. So let me unpack. There's a couple things that we should be familiar with, here. So the first thing that we should be familiar with is the PIN code. Now, I can't speak to every single cell phone provider that's out there, but I can speak to Verizon, and I can also speak to AT&T. You know, I've had phones both for business and personal on both of those services. What you can often do is you can set a PIN code, a billing code, to the actual account itself. That is not a password, but it's the code that has to be present to make any alterations or modifications to the account. I strongly recommend that you do that. You know, so if somebody calls up and they say, "Hey, I'm Steve Yass, let me in. Let me go ahead and change this PIN code." Their next question is going to be, "What's the PIN code to the account, sir?" You know, and if you don't know it, they're not supposed to make any modifications or changes. And it's not like they can be looking at your screen and then work around it. With Verizon anyway, like, it's like a password. The representative has to put it on their side to even unlock the account. And there's a whole separate escalation period if you lose that billing code, but don't do that. You know, make sure, use a password manager and lock it down on your own. So if you do not have a billing code associated with your mobile account, you absolutely should consider doing it. All you have to do is just call up and say, "I want to add a billing code," and they should just be able to add it right there for you. Maybe you could even add a note to your account saying, "Confirm with the driver's license of the person if it happens to be an in-person transfer." Okay, the second thing is, well, these fraudsters ended up calling T-Mobile several times in order to be able to get access to this person's account, and they kept calling until they got somebody cooperative. And unfortunately, that is pretty common. You know, with customer service representatives, they're typically underpaid, overworked. Frankly, you know, you run the risk of the incredibly competent and loyal and trustworthy and diligent in their jobs. And you got the other side that really just frankly don't really care. That's pretty common, for example, to people to call repeatedly until they get what they want to do. You know, I've seen folks in customer service related jobs, and their sole focus is, "How can I get this person off the phone the fast as I possibly can?" Because you know what? Their metrics and compensations and bonuses are really dealt around customer satisfaction and how many people they can deal with in a given time period. And so it's pretty common. They just hang up and call back, hang up and call back until they finally get somebody on the, you know, on that perfect day, that perfect storm, that maybe circumvents some of the procedures. The takeaway from that is none of this is law for the most part. Very, very little of security is actually written and codified into law, but rather everything is dictated around best practices. And with a lot of organizations, there's really kind of nothing that we can do to force them. You know, they really kind of have to utilize best practices and implement and take a strong interest in security, because there's nothing I can do to force Verizon to change, or AT&T for that matter. You know, they have to want to provide this. You know, I have to give kudos to Apple. You know, for better or worse, Apple has done a really, really good job at protecting consumer privacy in the recent years, much more than what we've seen with many other companies out there. And they take security seriously, and I really do applaud that. So how can we prevent this from occurring? So first, I would tell you to reconsider how you implement multi-factor authentication. And some of this you can control yourself, and others, you know, it's just really going to be a factor of whatever company you're working with. Okay, multi-factor authentication is one of three things: something you are, something you have, something you know. Well, something you know, the password isn't going away anytime, but something you have and something you are could change. You know, I would tell you whenever possible, maybe use something you are, like biometric, face scan, fingerprint scan, something like that. And if you can't do that, you might want to consider utilizing an authentication app rather than text messages. You know, if a hacker is able to gain access to your device using text messages and able to see your text messages, they're able to get around it. Okay. Now, the other alternative to this is, instead of using a text-based multi-factor approach, is instead to use an app-based multi-factor approach. Now, I personally utilize LastPass. Okay. So with LastPass, this is an app I run on my phone, and this app will generate codes related to the different services that I utilize. So Google or Microsoft or Amazon or any of these, I got a ton of them on here. So when I want to log in, for example, to an Amazon account or my LinkedIn or my Stripe account or, you know, whatever, you know, I don't actually go and get a text message. I open this app. This app uses Face ID, so it takes a facial recognition of my face. And then I scroll to the right service and I see, oh, it's 123456, you know, and I put that in. So the benefit is that those codes are only generated on this specific device. If the text message capabilities were turned off, it would not change my ability to be able to utilize this code for authentication purposes. They're separate from each other. And I would tell you that's the preferred way of handling it. You know, but again, you might not get that choice. It might be that that's the only thing that provider offers. But when in doubt, if you can choose between the two of them, I would recommend using the Authenticator app-based approach. Now, the biggest reason I always chose the Authenticator app approach is that I would often be traveling and in an area with low reception, or maybe working from Wi-Fi on a plane, and I wouldn't be able to get into an account if it was a text approach. But in hindsight, man, I made a really good decision because that's definitely the more secure way of handling it. Now, you might also want to add that SIM pin, as I mentioned. Okay, so here's some information regarding some of the other providers. For AT&T, it's just a matter of signing in, and then you can add an account passcode and enable what they call their Manage Extra Security. For Sprint, good news there, Sprint mandates PIN codes. If you're using T-Mobile, you just got to call up and you can add that PIN code. For Verizon, you could log into your account and add your PIN code there. I think you could also do it by the app as well. I would expect you to be able to. And remember, just like a password, nobody will ever call you and ask you for your PIN. They will call you if you are trying to change something on the account and, you know, they ask you for your PIN. That's completely normal. But it'll never be Verizon calling you and telling you, hey, we forgot your PIN. Can you please give it to us again? That would definitely be a phishing scheme. So in our next section here, let's go ahead and talk about preventing and detecting fraud with technology controls. Now, technology can be fantastic for helping to give us more eyes on the problem, giving us the tools to be able to resolve this issue, giving us the capability to process larger quantities of data. And it gives us the ability to have a force multiplier. You know, in the same way that a trailer allows a truck to carry a heck of a lot more from point A to point B, technology allows us to be able to do more with our organization with the same equivalent amount of resources. Now, technology controls are a subset of the enterprise's internal control policies. IT controls are really around the ideas and objectives of confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data. And it's a necessary component of the overall management of the IT function in that business enterprise. So it's a matter of just having it. I would tell you that in today's era that IT controls are internal controls because there's not a material business, there's not a business in the world that's not using technology in a very material way. So technology controls in general are really kind of like any other aspect of internal control. They're about mitigating risks to an acceptable level. And well-designed controls will be a mixture of preventative controls, detective controls, deterrent controls, and alternating controls. And this certainly applies in the realm of technology as well. So I personally think that if you don't have good technology controls, you really don't have any control inside of an organization. With tech, I mean, you could do anything with anything. It's about information at the end of the day. It could be something as, you know, something like, for example, writing checks out of the accounting system and changing the payroll or the payable information, or it could be, you know, for example, stealing data off the file server and taking it to a competitor. If you don't have these controls and they are not reliable, you know, you really can't rely upon anything inside of these systems. And so tech controls are internal controls. Now, the extent to which these controls are implemented should be based upon the risk appetite and the risk tolerance of the organization. The risk appetite is the degree that management is willing to take of risk. Risk tolerance is going to be the acceptable variation relative to achieving our organizational objectives. It changes depending on what organization you're with and what you're doing. I could tell you in our organization, we don't have a very high risk appetite. We're not a very risky company. And mostly just because we've seen the downside of this and we've seen what happens when people don't take security seriously and they use insecure passwords or they don't properly secure their computers by keeping them up to date or running, correct security software and hardware inside of their networks. A phrase I like to say is, I mean, it's a very thin veil between getting breached and not breached. And for a lot of organizations, if you haven't experienced a data breach up to this point, it really is by the grace of God. So many organizations have that do it absolutely correct, that invest, that have people, they have resources, they have software, they have hardware to bring their risk down to an acceptable level, still experience a data breach. And there are organizations that do nothing, you know, and the fact that they haven't been breached is really kind of amazing. And I would say it's more of a waiting game than anything else. You know, something I'll often hear, for example, is, oh, we're a small business. We're a mom-pop shop. You know, we're a small accounting practice in Des Moines, Iowa. You know, we're a, you know, a small manufacturing firm in Duluth or, you know, whatever. You know, why would anybody want to hack us? Why would anybody want to steal from us? You know, we got nothing. And the reality is, I mean, if anything, you're a target. You know, big companies, Microsoft, the Amazons, the Googles of the world, they've got $1 billion in the bank. They've got budget. They've got people. They've got shareholders they're responsible to. They're at least going to put up a fight. But I mean, you don't. I mean, if you make yourself a target, it's only a matter of time until somebody figures it out. And it could be a hacker halfway around the world, or it could just be somebody on Main Street that essentially is exploiting your organization to steal in some capacity. But I would tell you that being small is not an excuse with respect to not having this type of technology and not having the proper controls in place in today's environment. Now, at a high level, working within technology controls is no different than working with really kind of any other controls inside of the organization. Okay, so here's kind of a paradigm I'd recommend. First and foremost, we want to identify and understand what we're doing here. So we work with the environment to understand what we face, what type of particular issues and hazards that are present in this particular environment. I mean, some environments lend themselves to certain risks than others. You know, if it's a cash heavy environment, you know, for a bank, well, that's going to look a lot different than a firm that specializes in generating intellectual property or a firm that deals with personally identifiable information like tax returns. So understand what you're going for. Now, if you're not sure, you know, what people are going to steal from you, think about how you make your money. And that will be the thing that people want to steal. If you're a professional service firm, it's going to be PII. If you are a bank, it's going to be cash. If you are a manufacturing company, it could be raw materials or finished goods or something like that. We want to conduct some inventories and walkthroughs. We want to ideally understand the process. And then based off of what we understand about the environment, based off of what people tell us, well, this is where we're going to go ahead and design our series of controls. And then we ultimately test and validate to ensure that these controls are effective for whatever we do. I would also say as a point of this, you should build some assumptions and then test for those assumptions. And so what do I mean by that? You know, you should, for example, try to figure out some ways that outcomes that you're expecting and then find whether or not that your controls meet those specific objectives. And then if not, well, why didn't it? And then try to work to achieve whatever that goal might be. And if you've got those objectives, you have a target for you to be able to hit. Now, IT controls are divided into two more focused categories. We have general controls and application controls. General controls are all the things that you normally hear in a security course. Good passwords, two-factor authentication, keep your computers up to date, don't let random people walk around your office, stuff like this. It's general stuff related to the overall application framework of the company, the overall technology infrastructure of the company. And then we also have IT application controls, which are going to be controls focused on specific applications. If it's going to be, for example, accounts payable, accounts receivable, well, you know, what can we do within our financial system, you know, in this case, that application to control and reduce risk as it relates to those individual functions. You cannot have any degree of trust in application controls unless you have good general controls in the company. They are interdependent on each other. Depending on the nature of your organization, you may or may not have application controls. I really hope you do, but you absolutely should have these general controls because they are the baseline for all future control to be built upon it. So let's go ahead and talk about information technology general controls here. So broadly speaking, these are the controls that apply across the organization, independent of the specific systems, independent of the specific data, the computers, the servers. And these are the controls that are there to help maintain integrity of all other stuff inside the company, the data, the applications and systems, to ensure that they are properly developed, implemented, operated, and secured. They can be thought of as kind of like our perimeter defense. You know, I can't really secure the home unless I have a lock on the front door. You know, I can't really secure the home unless there's an alarm system. I can't really secure the home unless, you know, it's in a safe neighborhood. You know, these are kind of preliminary things that we should kind of think of. They're our first line of defense inside of our organization, whereas our application controls focus on the specific applications and processes. Now, our general controls typically focus on a couple of areas, and there are about 10 in particular. Okay, our control environment, which we've already discussed about, which is the operation of the actual company. Okay, we have the change management, how we're going to implement change across the organization. For companies that are developing software, you know, or developing their own intellectual property, we have the source code, the documentation, and the revision processes. I'll give you just a quick example of why that is so very important. Go ahead and shoot me a chat message if you're familiar with this story. How many of you heard about the data breach that occurred at SolarWinds earlier this year? Okay. If you haven't, here's just a quick recap of it. There's an IT software company called SolarWinds. SolarWinds makes server software that's used to update and patch and monitor server infrastructure. It's used by pretty much everybody in the Fortune 500. It's used by pretty much everybody in government agencies, including the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, and others. This is software that you probably yourself wouldn't use, but a guy like me probably would. And this would allow me to be able to monitor the infrastructure for a client or for our organization. You know, think about, let's just pick a, you know, Acme Brick Company as an example. You're just an arbitrary company. Let's say Acme is a Fortune 500. They probably have thousands of computers, maybe even hundreds, maybe thousands of servers, printers, network gear, switches. Have you ever thought about, for those big companies, how the heck do they keep all that stuff up to date? You know, how the heck do they know when there's a security update, and how do they apply it across 500 servers simultaneously, or the, you know, 6,000 laptops that are out for the company? Well, SolarWinds is this application that essentially would manage this, report upon it for inventory purposes, fixed asset purposes, but then really management purposes. And so it's really specialized stuff, not cheap. A lot of people used it, and it's good stuff. Well, unfortunately, they did not maintain a good development environment for their software, and a hacker group, most likely overseas in Russia, was able to infiltrate the SolarWinds development environment and was able to sneak malware into this update that got pushed out to all of the SolarWinds users. And this update eventually caused a data breach inside of SolarWinds that exposed corporate infrastructure for most of the Fortune 500, as well as the Department of Defense and Homeland Security. And it all came because of sloppy practices with respect to maintaining their application. Now, what was really dangerous about this is that that update, that wasn't malware that that company designed. It wasn't malware that the victim company downloaded and installed. Think about a Windows update, for example. Hopefully all of you update every single day, you know, and hopefully that you're applying those updates as fast as Microsoft or Adobe or whatever other company you're utilizing pushes them out. Updates are often the difference between experiencing a data breach or not experiencing a data breach. And in a lot of respects, you know, they're required. I mean, if you haven't done them, I mean, you're really posing yourself a risk. Let me give you an example here. So I'm over here on my virtual machine, and I've got a Windows update pending. Okay. Now, in SolarWinds instance, these customers had their own systems, and, you know, they updated the software. But let me ask you a question. How do you know that this software update is actually from Windows and from Microsoft? How do you know that that's actually coming from them? Well, it actually is. So I don't want to cast any doubt there. But in SolarWinds instances, somebody up here was able to infiltrate their source code, infiltrate their environment, infect the update with malware, and then all these normal customers that aren't expecting anything click this update button, and then they infect their machines with malware. The takeaway from this is that if you're building software, you got to do it carefully, because, you know, when something gets out there in the wild like that, it can be very difficult, if not impossible, to actually pull back. So with respect to our application service providers, you know, we need to make sure that we're doing business with good people that are following correct practices and keeping their environment secure themselves, because I'm only as secure as the people we're doing business with. So I don't want to give you any doubt with Microsoft or any of the other major providers. In a lot of ways, this was one of the most sophisticated data breaches that ever occurred. But the takeaway from this is that the client victim companies did nothing wrong. They thought they were getting a good and valid update, but in reality, they were downloading malware because the company's environment was infected. Okay, logical access policies, standards, and applications. Actually developing this stuff, you know, in terms of what your best practices are for access and what applications you're going to use, and standardizing it to follow best practices with respect to what you're doing. I mean, half your company shouldn't be on Google Workspace and half your company be on 365. You pick one, you standardize, you build access policies around it, and there you go. You should have incident management and reporting policies. When something occurs, your people can tell you about it. Problem management and problem policies and procedures. Technical support, hardware, standardized hardware software configuration, standard security configuration. Unfortunately, not nearly enough disaster recovery, business continuity. You know, if your organization doesn't have disaster planning and disaster recovery, business continuity operations at this point in time, you're posing a significant risk to your company. Just to do a quick plug, the CP Today podcast with the K2 instructors, we've covered 3 episodes on disaster recovery and business continuity. So if you're interested in building your own plan, check out the podcast. There's 3 free episodes on those topics specifically. IT general controls are the controls that should be in place to provide a reasonable assurance that with respect to security, stability, reliability, and I'll also throw availability of the organization's IT structure is maintained. And it's of particular importance to anything involving security, personally identifiable information, and financial payment systems inside of the organization. Now, IT general controls are typically grouped into 4 big categories that we should be aware of. IT general controls focus around access to programs and data, program changes, program development, and then also our computer operations. Now, some of this will apply and some of it won't. It's just going to depend on the nature of the organization for what you're doing. But I would say everybody is going to have computer operations as a major component of their general controls. You're only as secure as your weakest link inside your company. Now, a couple of really cool resources to help you get started with this. So DumpSec was a great tool, for example, to get a complete listing of all the software on a particular computer or server. Likewise, BellArc does something very similar to this. Wireshark is a really cool tool for analyzing traffic coming in and out of your company and in and out of your organization. Another really cool tool, this is a website you can go check out. This website is called Shodan. And Shodan is a tool that you can use to scan a particular company, network, or IP address to see if there are any publicly exposed servers that could potentially cause you issues. Now, Shodan is a search engine. You know, if we wanted to find something, for example, out about, a particular topic, what would we do? Well, we would go to Google. We'd Google search and we'd find out, you know, about that particular topic. If I wanted to know more about a restaurant, I might use Google Maps or I might use Yelp. If I want to find something out about a person professionally, probably LinkedIn. Well, Shodan is a website that we can use to find information out about systems and about technology. And it's a search engine for Internet of Things devices, everything from, connected home thermostats to nuclear power plants, inventory systems, and more. And it does a lot of really compelling things. One of the things that you can do here is you can put in an IP address, or you can put in a company name, and it'll tell you if there's anything on the web for that particular company or IP. I'm going to give you a quick example here. How many of you are utilizing Remote Desktop Protocol, or RDP? Sometimes referred to as RDC, Remote Desktop Connection. It's Windows' native tool to be able to remote access something. If you ever come over here to the Start menu and you type in Remote Desktop Connection, it's this little guy. You know, and this little guy allows you to put in an IP address, and then you can connect to something over the internet. Okay. Now, RDP is awesome. It's one of the best remote access tools you could possibly do. However, if it is not secured, it is an absolute magnet for malware, a magnet for data breaches, and a nightmare to maintain. In order for RDP, RDC to work correctly, it has to be behind a VPN, and there has to be multi-factor authentication in order for this to work. So I'll give you a quick example of this. RDP uses port 3389. A port is the doorway to a particular network. And it's the doorway for specific types of data to move from one way in or out of that network. And so Remote Desktop Protocol uses door 3389. Well, there are 3,756,422 servers publicly listing port 3389 as being available on their computer. Okay, so we can see over here there's 1.2 million based here in the United States. Let's go ahead and search for something maybe a little bit back in time. Let's look for an older version of the operating system, in this case, Windows Server 2003. Despite our best efforts, people still use old software. If I were to give you one recommendation with respect to security, keep your devices up to date. Let me ask the audience, leave me a comment if you think of what you think. But do you think Windows software that came out almost two decades ago is still secure in 2021? Well, the answer is probably not. Well, in this case, of the machines that are advertising that they have port 3389 open, there are 1,400 that are utilizing Windows Server 2003. And we can see there's 255 here in the United States. And we can actually use this tool to drill down, you know, to kind of figure out what computers, what servers, and what they are. And so if we could continue to look down here, we can drill in ultimately. Let's just pick on the first one we see here. Okay. And we can ultimately see what this computer is hosting. And so we can see it's got port 3389, and we can even see what version R2 that they are running. Okay. So this tool can be very useful to help you understand where you potentially could have exposure in your networks. It's a great way of scanning your computer networks to see if there's potential issues that might pop up here. It's incredible. If you type in, check this out, default password. Okay. There are 31,000 devices advertising their default password, you know? And so this is a great way of being able to determine, again, superficially, if you've got kind of these exposures out there. You know, it's not going to catch everything, but I will tell you it's better than not knowing. All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed our presentation for today. Let's go ahead and have three quick review questions and then wrap up. Our first review question, which of the following internal controls could be compromised by a SIM card fraud? So SIM cards, again, are those chips that go inside the phones. And increasingly with modern phones, they're actually virtual. So thankfully, we actually don't have the physical risk of SIMs any longer. But it was what ties the phone to the carrier. So the carrier knows essentially your phone is you. Right. So if you were to compromise that, what are some of the issues that might pop up? Okay. Would it be a management review, exception reports? Nope. That's inside of the system itself, the accounting system, ERP, whatever it is, not an issue. Management review of access logs. Again, not an issue. If you've already gotten that point, you're too far gone. Reconciliation. Nope. Correct answer here is going to be multi-factor authentication text messages. If I can compromise the cell phone, I can hijack those text messages and have them sent to an alternative device, ultimately gaining access to the system. And then I can do all the other nasty things that are listed here, including, you know, potentially modifying the accounting system itself. It's always best to keep the bad guys out. The best way to keep them out is to keep your devices secure. Eliminate the risk to begin with. All right, polling question number two. Which of the following statements is true regarding the definition of information technology controls? Okay, is it information technology controls could and should be used to eliminate information technology risk in an organization? That is incorrect. You know, there's really no way to ever completely eliminate risk. And if you could, the cost would be astronomical. You know, what we want to focus on is making it appropriate and acceptable to the organization. You know, it's risk appetite. So we want to minimize it to something that's going to be more acceptable. Information technology controls take priority over all other forms of internal control. No, that is not the case. It works in conjunction. They're like your children. You don't like one more than the other. You like them all equally, but they're all equally important. Information technology controls typically consist of preventative controls. It's not true. It can be detective, deterrent, compensating, as well as others as well. So the correct answer here is information technology controls are a subset of an organization's entire internal control structure. So it's a piece of it, but it is not the whole kit and caboodle. It's not the whole meal. It is just a piece of that. Our third review question. Which of the following is true of information technology general controls? Okay, information technology general controls focus on specific applications and processes in an organization. Nope, that is application controls, which we will cover in our next podcast. Is it information technology general controls would govern what rights a user has within an application? Nope, that is still application controls. Is it information technology general controls typically are not as important as application controls? No. They are the basis of trust. If they're not there, we can't build application controls. So the correct answer here is information technology controls apply across the entire organization, all end users within the organization, all applications, systems, network, and data. They are the fundamental nature of how controls are applied at a technology level and an integral component of the overall control structure of a company. All right, folks, that does bring us to the end. Let's talk about what we learned today. Well, today we continued our examples and review of case studies of fraud, looking at the case of Cindy Mills and Matthews International, as well as Rita Crunwell. We talked a little bit about SIM card fraud, what it is and how it works. And we also started our conversation with respect to examining technology controls, starting first with our IT general controls, and took a look at some of the major groups of how we group general controls to be effective inside of an organization. Now, in our next edition of this, we will go ahead and continue that discussion, looking at general controls and then getting into application controls with the goal and hope of improving internal control overall inside of our company. Technology and controls, they all go hand in hand these days. And if you think about it, accounting at the end of the day is really just a collection of information. And technology is how we facilitate that collection, the recording, and then ultimately recalling of information. If we don't have internal controls there, we have no basis of trust for our organization. Now, I do want to remind you, if you're a financial professional, you can earn credits for this podcast that you just listened to. Head on over to cpetoday.com and use course code CSF3. Take a short 5-question quiz, and you'll earn a credit for today's class. In addition to the podcast, you can find courses on all ranges of topics, from accounting, audit, personal development, Excel, QuickBooks, and more. If you enjoy our content, please consider reaching out and connecting with us on social media. You can find us on almost all social media at CPE Today, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and more. We'd love for you to leave a comment, reach out, and say hello. And you can always get our content for free, coming to you live twice a week, broadcasting on Facebook and YouTube, typically at about 11 o'clock Pacific time. Or you can get it on your own time and enjoy on your own time wherever you happen to get your content, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and others. Please consider leaving a like, a comment, a review. That really helps spread the word about what we're doing here. Always my pleasure being with you here, and I look forward to seeing you back in the office the next time around. Take care.